You asked and we answered. Today on the podcast, we have Dr. Ari Calhoun, naturopathic doctor and pediatric neurodevelopmental specialist, on to talk about vaccines from a brain development point of view. Our goal was to tease apart the tough decision-making parents either want or have to make for various reasons, and Dr. Ari shares an individualized approach that we wish all families received. Assessing risk factors for illness, as well as using other methods of risk mitigation, are important parts of this conversation. We discuss vaccination during pregnancy, the immune system's role in normal neurodevelopment, how the brain gets primed for inflammation, the problems with the current schedule, and ways to optimize a delayed schedule, detox, autism, testing, measles, and more. So here we go.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Okay, welcome, Dr. Calhoun, Ari Calhoun. We are friends and colleagues. We went to school together. I'm just going to say it, you were the smartest girl in our class. You were, and you can just own that. And everyone wanted to study with you except for me because I was like, nope, I can't. I can't compare myself. No, I'm just kidding. I am so happy to have you on today. I want to read your bio. We're going to talk all about vaccines, and you have become such an expert in vaccines and neurodevelopment and all different things to do with pediatric brain health. And it is so amazing to watch you. And I know that you're making such a big difference in so many families' lives as well. So I want to read your little bio first before we get going so that people know who you are and what you stand for in this conversation, which I know is like a very loaded conversation and some people are going to be triggered. And it's like, you know what, whatever, like just let's all have an open ear and open mind when we're discussing this matter, because I think that there's a lot more angles to it than what we hear. And so it's going to be fascinating to get your take on a lot of things. So Dr. Ari Calhoun is the owner of Wholesome Brain Medicine, a functional medicine practice and consulting team focused on optimizing neurodevelopment and emotional regulation from the womb onwards. As an adjunct faculty at the Medical Academy of Pediatrics, she is a passionate speaker and educator on the importance of a biomedical approach towards neurodevelopment disorders. Also, I just really want to say really quick, your podcast episode, which I'll link in the show notes, about optimizing neurodevelopment of your fetus while you are pregnant is one of our most downloaded episodes and people absolutely love it. So you'll definitely need to listen in on that one. And I will link that below. So don't worry about finding it right now. Anyways, continuing with this bio, within the world of neurodevelopment, she is particularly passionate about prevention through perinatal and early development optimization. While recognizing the intricate link between the immune system and neurodevelopment, she has co-founded the Vaccine Empowerment Program, which helps support patients in making difficult vaccine decisions. Thank you for making that program. It is awesome. Dr. Calhoun is a founding supplement formulator and part of the clinical research team at Needed, where she helps to ensure nutritional support during pregnancy and postpartum goes beyond just the essentials to comprehensively support both mom and baby, thereby optimizing neurodevelopment outcomes for our future generation. Like, okay, jaw drop, mic drop. You are just amazing. We are so happy to have you.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. This is the highlight of my day. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Okay, great. And I really trust you in your due diligence. I know how you are as a person and as a mom and as a practitioner and a researcher and just your integrity and the way that you look at things. And I also think it's really impressive how you are constantly checking your bias and you're not afraid to really just stand in what it is that you're seeing in the research and then also what you see clinically and how to manage kind of that, find the intersection between the natural world, the conventional world, you know, especially when you're dealing with really challenging cases. I know you see a lot of autism spectrum disorders and PANS and PANDAs and all of these really challenging things. And sometimes, you know, you have to dip into the world of pharmaceuticals more, or you have to, you know, you're such a good blend of all of the forms of medicine that exist, I think. And so your perspective on vaccines, which is a really polarizing topic. People seem to be either completely all for it, no questions asked, or absolutely not, no, never. And I feel like we both agree that that is probably not a very helpful perspective to be in either of those camps. So we're going to kind of talk about the middle ground. And I polled our Instagram community of what were the questions that people had. And there was definitely some recurrent themes. And so we want to tackle as many of those questions as we can today.
Great.
And if you don't mind, I think we should jump in. But, you know, maybe like, can you kind of talk about how your perspective has come to change based on your population base and the work that you do in this arena in general?
Yeah, I think that's definitely formed and shaped my opinion. And I also think just my perspective, or I would say commitment to diving into the research, has also really had an impact in how I've come to understand vaccinations. So as you know, in naturopathic medical school, we are very much taught kind of the CDC perspective on vaccines and not much more. It's actually, I mean, at least with our schooling, it was kind of this closed door topic. This is what we learn. There might be alternative perspectives from the faculty or from the students, but we're not going to discuss that matter. So when we graduated, we kind of knew this is the CDC recommendation and that's it. And yet, you know, in terms of like philosophically, that didn't necessarily align with a lot of the other naturopathic principles. And so I think many of us graduated uncertain around vaccinations. And so that is what really, you know, the birth of my daughter, or being pregnant with my daughter, really brought about a lot of questions. And I needed to know this personally for my own family. And so that's when I really started diving into vaccines and vaccine research, because I cared. I wanted to know as a mom. And I thought that, you know, if I am a clinician and I feel so insecure about my decisions regarding this topic, there has to be so many other mothers who are feeling the exact same way. And so that's when I first kind of started to dive in. And then as my career has developed, I've obviously taken a, you know, deep focus in neurodevelopment and neuropsychiatric conditions. And this is one of the most controversial topics when it comes to vaccinations. One of the most feared adverse reactions is a neurodevelopment regression. And I've had countless patients come into my office, sit in front of me, and tell me that their child was developing typically until a particular vaccine, and then they regressed. And so I wanted to understand that. And, you know, I think that this is obviously very controversial. And, you know, I can review, and this is something that I've done through our vaccine empowerment program, reviewed all the research over the years. Where did the original research around vaccines and altered neurodevelopment come from? What has the research been since then? And what else do we know about the intersection between the immune system and brain health? And that's really become such a crucial area in my practice. I think the immune system plays arguably the most important role in how the brain develops. So to subtract vaccinations out of that conversation just doesn't make any logical sense when we know that that's the biggest immune input in a child's life, in their first year of life. We know that there's nothing that is, you know, playing a greater role in their immune system development than vaccines if we are doing the standard CBC schedule. So that's kind of, yes, I took a personal interest in vaccines because it affected me as a mother and my family. And then, you know, as I've gone into practice, it's now something that has taken a, you know, pretty big section of my practice. And in that, I see children who are vaccine injured, both from a neurodevelopment standpoint, but also, you know, various other vaccine injuries, as they seek out practitioners who kind of understand and give them the ear to express their concerns.
Yeah, because that's a place where a lot of them are just finding a total brick wall, or a lot of gaslighting and being told that's not happening and you're crazy, you don't know what you're talking about, blah, blah, blah. There was all these other factors. And it's hard to have a really good, robust research study too. It's just all going to be a lot of retrospective comparing populations, correct? I mean, we there's not really going to be a situation where they're going to be able to set up children and control for every factor of their life and give some vaccine, some not, and then see what happens. It's just like not the way that it works.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is difficult to have research around this area. And there's a way to gain some knowledge. I don't think that it's impossible to research this. And there have been pediatricians that have evaluated their practice and kind of looked at their unvaccinated population and their vaccinated population and have put out research, and that research has been retracted. And so I think that this is something that, you know, definitely needs more research. Everyone agrees on that.
Ooh, their research has been retracted because it was going against the mainstream narrative of what...
Potentially, right? I don't know.
I know. Isn't it funny? It's so unfortunate we have to dance around these topics, but it is the way that it is. And I just wanted to touch on something else you said, which was about our education. And it is... I remember that so clearly. I literally remember the day that we were talking about the CDC schedule in our maternal fetal medicine type class. Mm-hmm. And that was... There was like maybe 1 day, 2 days of conversation around it. We had to write a paper about one particular vaccine as well. I remember that. And then it was done. And all of us were asking questions and the professor was really kind of just beating around the bush, wouldn't say that much else. And was, you could tell that maybe she wanted to, but it wasn't going to be something that we were going to be given. And everybody was very odd about it. And I remember just being like, wait, what? You guys are going to tell it? It was so odd to me. Yeah. And it's just unfortunate that that's what's happening. And even if that's happening in a naturopathic medical college, can you imagine what's happening right elsewhere? And it's like, we need to be able to have these open, hey, maybe there's room for improvement, or maybe there's a different way to do this. Yeah. I mean, it's probably a hopeless dream in this situation, but
I don't know that it's hopeless. I think we are at the brink of something. People have to change their approach a little bit because people are acknowledging that this is not, you know, the standard recommendation is not the best recommendation for the vast majority of children. So, I'm hopeful that there might be a little bit of change, but it's definitely like tension around this conversation.
For sure. Okay, so let's dive into the questions that came in, and I gathered them up into sort of what was the most recurrent questions so that we can tackle them and, appease people's curiosity. So the number one thing that people wanted to know about was vaccines in pregnancy. So DTaP, the flu vaccine, and the COVID vaccine are the ones that are currently mm-hmm. recommended to pregnant women.
And RSV now.
Oh, and RSV now. Yes, mm-hmm. exactly. Now a new RSV one. So safety, efficacy, what are your thoughts on this? I know this is a loaded one.
Yeah, I know. So I was looking through the questions that you had sent over last night, and I was like, we actually could talk about a whole hour on each of these questions, right? So I'll try to be as like concise as possible. I think there's two main concerns here, right? So we're either using vaccinations to protect mother from a more serious illness in pregnancy, because we know that pregnancy impacts your immune health and it makes you more susceptible to more severe illness in pregnancy. So we're doing a vaccine to protect the mother, and then that also can in some ways protect the baby and protect the pregnancy. Okay, or we're using vaccines as a way to protect the offspring. So there are certain illnesses that children are kind of most susceptible to, the riskiest forms of these illnesses during those first 3 months, and maybe there isn't a vaccine available, or you have to delay a particular vaccine, it's not available right at birth. And so we want to protect the babies during this most vulnerable time. And that is the way that we do that is through vaccinating mom, and then mom passes on her antibodies in that second and third trimester, and then baby is born with mom's antibodies that attack that particular infection. So we'll talk about the ones that protect mom first, or why we're using those. So the ones that protect mom are going to be the flu vaccine and the COVID vaccine. And these are recommended in pregnancy, again, just to protect mothers from a more severe form of these illnesses. So we know that if moms were to get COVID or to get the flu, they're more likely to have a severe infection in pregnancy than if they were not pregnant, because their immune system is in this kind of suppressed state, and our immune system kind of alters in order to avoid us rejecting the fetus. Okay. And so we definitely want to protect moms. And as a provider who specializes in neurodevelopment, we also know that these infections, the flu and COVID, are risks for neurodevelopment disorders. Specifically, or I think we have the most research around autism, but this definitely also goes beyond that. And we see this research in as it pertains to ADHD and tics, Tourette's, schizophrenia, other types of neuropsychiatric illness. Okay. And so I talk about this a little bit on that other podcast, but I'll summarize it a little bit here. So if mom gets an infection and it's really severe, so let's say the flu or COVID lands her in the hospital, what we can assume is that with that infection, she probably had a very high inflammatory load. And those inflammatory molecules don't just stay in mom, but they can cross the placenta and then get into baby, and they can impact baby's brain development. And they do that by activating these cells called the microglia within the brain. And once these microglia are kind of primed or activated, they become much more sensitive to other types of activation or kind of inflammation, gut dysbiosis, toxins, and the microglia play a very big role in development. They set up new pathways, they tear down old pathways, and they kind of regulate the inflammatory state in the brain. So when they become activated and dysregulated, they stop normal neurodevelopment and they cause a bunch of inflammation in the brain, which can alter neurotransmitters and the like. And so that picture of that neuroinflammation can kind of mimic and you know, can cause autism-like symptoms, okay? And so we know that illness in pregnancy is a risk factor for autism. And we know that about the flu. We know that about COVID now. Now, if you have, it does kind of change whether you have a girl or a boy fetus. Boys are way more susceptible to this microglial activation. And it has something to do with hormones. We don't know everything, but they're way more susceptible. So that's kind of the aim here is we'll give these vaccines to protect mom and to protect baby. So that's number one. Now, number two, I'll talk about like why would we give them, and then we'll talk about kind of like the cons, the pros and cons. So when it comes to Tdap, okay, so we give Tdap in pregnancy, usually towards end of second trimester, beginning of third trimester. And the goal here is to pass on as many pertussis antibodies as possible to baby so that when baby is born, they're born with some level of protection if they were to encounter pertussis. So pertussis is also known as the whooping cough or the 100-day cough, and it's a bacteria that secretes a toxin, and that toxin causes a lot of mucus production and narrowing of the airways. And, you know, it can be quite significant in younger children just because anatomically they have very small airways. So if we have like a tiny little straw and we occlude that with like mucus or anything in the way, if that becomes narrower, it's going to impact oxygen exchange. And so those children under 3 months of age are really most susceptible to hospitalization and then death from pertussis. Okay. So that's the time period that we really want to protect them. Now, we do give a DTaP vaccine to babies, and the earliest you can do DTaP is 6 weeks. Usually it's given at 2 months. So the thought is that if we give Tdap, then mom's antibodies are kind of protecting baby during those first 2 months of life before they're a candidate for the DTaP vaccine. So that's why we give that one. And then for RSV, we just had an RSV vaccine that entered the market for moms in the third trimester this past fall of 2023. And so now that's offered for moms. And we don't have a vaccine for babies, but we now also have a monoclonal antibody that can be given, and it kind of operates like a vaccine. So it's just like it's giving the baby antibodies so that the antibodies can then kind of work in lieu of the baby's immune system to protect the baby against RSV. But both of those are kind of used interchangeably. I guess they could also be used together to protect infants from RSV. We know that RSV is ubiquitous. Every child is going to encounter it within their first 2 years of life. And it is riskiest for, again, these younger children just because anatomically their airways are smaller. So those are the reasons we give vaccines, okay? Now, what are kind of the cons or the risks around vaccines? So I think, again, most notably, is that they are all forms of immune activation. And so as a provider who specializes in neurodevelopment, it's possible, and I've seen, you know, a number of patients of mine who've chosen to get the flu vaccine, the COVID vaccine, Tdap, and had an adverse reaction. That is not everybody, but that can be a possibility. And so let's say there's a huge inflammatory response from the vaccine, they're laid up in bed for a week, something of that nature. That too releases a bunch of inflammatory cytokines, and that too could be a risk for neurodevelopment because there's an inflammatory response. For moms who have autoimmunity, that might be a higher likelihood because their immune system is already susceptible to forming a dysregulated response or moms that have kind of hypersensitivity conditions like asthma or eczema, again, they might be a little bit more susceptible to that hyperinflammatory response, and that might increase their likelihood of, you know, forming an inflammatory response and that potentially impacting baby's brain. Because we know that this maternal immune activation can impact fetal brain health. So that's number one. Number two, and what most people are concerned about, are the other alternate, like other ingredients within vaccines. So when it comes to the flu vaccine, there is still thimerosal, which is a mercury derivative in multi-dose flu vaccines. It's not within every flu vaccine. So if it's a single-dose flu vaccine, it's not within that. But if it's a multi-dose flu vaccine, mercury is in there as a preservative. And we know that mercury levels in pregnancy have to be really low, or that could potentially impact baby's brain health. And that is why we recommend, or they recommend, not eating fish very often in pregnancy. So there is a lot of concern around mercury being, you know, potentially harmful, and that as a additional ingredient being something you want to avoid in pregnancy. Within Tdap, there is aluminum. Now, the aluminum within the Tdap vaccine is much lower than that they give baby in the Dtap vaccine. So some moms say, like, well, I'd rather get it in pregnancy than give it to my child at 2 months of age, and then their liver is going to filter out some of that. But aluminum is also a neurotoxin. And so we have to assume that there's potentially some of that that's crossing in over the placenta. And then each of these have their own kind of set of side effects. So for instance, with the RSV vaccine that has come out, there are increased risk of hypertensive disorders. There's a little bit of increased risk of premature birth or preterm birth. And so, you know, I think all vaccines have to be weighed with this level of pros and cons. The other thing about these is that, you know, when it comes to specifically like COVID and flu, when we're talking about efficacy, it's not super high. So if we had 100%, you are not going to get the flu or you're not going to get COVID, that might be a little bit of a different conversation than what we're seeing right now with the COVID vaccines and the flu vaccines. So there was a Cochrane review that looked at the flu vaccine, and it said that we had to vaccinate 100 people on an average year to prevent one case of the flu. So we know that the flu vaccine is just not terribly effective, and we might choose other therapeutics to kind of decrease our, you know, likelihood of getting the flu or our severity of the flu versus the flu vaccine.
Wow. Awesome. Thank you so much for all of that. That was a really great breakdown. And so it's almost like you're taking this risk. You're trying to maybe give the vaccines while pregnant so you avoid getting the illness, which could cause this big inflammatory response. But the vaccine itself, might cause the big inflammatory response.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's such a hard thing for people to weigh. How to do this and not. And one thing that I know that lacks is the safety research around vaccines and pregnancy. Can you speak to that for a minute?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Pregnancy in general is just this protected time period. We don't have research in pregnancy, and it's actually interesting. Obviously, like we know. There has been some studies around the flu vaccine and in pregnancy and risk. And, you know, there are some studies around the flu vaccine and pregnancy and autism, but there's not a lot, right? So we might say there's not enough research, or there's not the same amount of research as we know, you know, in comparison to the flu in pregnancy and risk for autism. So we don't have the same amount of research because it's a protected population. Same thing with COVID vaccine. There's research around COVID and autism. Or COVID in pregnancy, I should say, in autism. And there's animal research about COVID vaccine in pregnancy and autism, but we haven't made that yet into the human population. And so these things take time. It's a protected population. We don't study it a lot. I think it's a good and bad thing, right? Like, I'm glad we protect pregnant women as we do, but we're just not, you know, there's so many drugs out there where they're sitting in this zone. Like, same thing with herbs. It's like, I don't know. Is it safe? Is it unsafe? We don't know, because it really hasn't been studied. So
yeah, we just have to make the decision clinically to see and move forward with that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then you mentioned monoclonal antibodies for the RSV. It's like, it's making me think, why don't we just give, do you think that maybe in the future with our technologies advancing that everything will start to transition towards maybe just giving monoclonal antibodies in lieu of the vaccination that's going to have the adjuvants, if we can just be giving babies these passive antibodies?
It's an interesting thought. So I think in general, monoclonal antibodies are like not just it's a drug, right? So we're thinking about like, okay, we're going to give our kids now, I don't know, you know, 15 different drugs, 15 different monoclonal antibodies.
Yeah.
I think we don't have a long enough track record to know how safe that is, right? So they do carry risk. We know that. I don't offer vaccines in my practice. I don't offer the monoclonal antibody in my practice. So I really can't speak to it firsthand because it just came out. The doctors I have talked to who are giving it say that they've seen very few side effects and they've seen, you know, they can't really, it's hard to speak to efficacy just because you're kind of hard to watch that. Don't know if they've been exposed or not, but in terms of side effects, they see less side effects with it than the vaccinations. But it's been out for like such a small period of time that I think we really need to watch it for the next couple of years before we really understand the safety and the efficacy. But it's possible. Now, they don't last forever. So that's the, you know, the deterring factor. You'd have to continue to get them if you want to continue to maintain that protection. But potentially you could say, instead of giving, let's say, DTaP at 2 months of age, because we don't want to, you know, add this huge aluminum load to a 2-month-old, we'll give the pertussis antibody because that's the antibody that we care most about, or not the antibody, but I should say, yes, the antibody, the monoclonal antibody for pertussis. And that might be more protective and protect them during the time period where they're most vulnerable or we care about them most. So absolutely. I think it's like a possibility, but we'll, so we're too,
yeah,
too
I think that would be, that would just be so interesting if we had more of a bridged type of in the future, maybe as we have the technology, the research, cause I know that they can be expensive as well, just because they're new, but maybe one day there will be something where the logic follows that, like you just said, which is that if of the Tdap, you know, we're not that worried about tetanus or diphtheria in a 2-month-old, diphtheria in this country at least, and it's the pertussis aspect. So interesting. Yes. Okay. This is fantastic. And what do you think about the, speaking of efficacy, of giving Tdap then to a pregnant woman for the purpose of the antibody production?
Yeah, I mean, like, as far as we know, it is effective. It's hard. Some of these things, it's like so difficult to assess like efficacy rates, or we just don't have enough data. We just don't have enough 2-month-old, 3-month-olds being exposed to pertussis to really like test that data. But yes, I think it's an effective strategy. We know that they carry the antibodies. We know that because we actually see that mom's antibodies really impact the efficacy of the vaccines. So we know that these antibodies are in there and they are neutralizing the antigens that come in, so much so that if you give Tdap in pregnancy, the vaccine at 2 months of age is rendered ineffective for that. So, you know, we do know, now it has a half-life, you know, pertussis has a half-life, so we don't know exactly how long, but it does at least protect them during that most vulnerable stage, those first 3 months.
So that is something that also should be taken into account then, right? For a child's own CDC schedule is, did mom get the Tdap vaccine in pregnancy? Because then now she can skip the 2-month DTaP for her baby, which is a huge aluminum dump. Right? So it's like, these are the kinds of things that I wish that were more on this individualized plane, right?
Yeah,
as I'm sure you absolutely do as well. And that leads into this next question of mine too, which is that what in your opinion are the problems with the current CDC schedule?
Okay. So what I share with all of my patients is, okay, who created the schedule and why? Because I think just having that perspective helps us understand, you know, why it is the way it is and why it might not apply to our child. So it is created by a public health system. The public health system is concerned about two main issues. They're concerned about decreasing disease rates as a whole. Okay. So they want to see pertussis go from, you know, 80,000 cases to 2,000 cases. They want to see measles go from 50,000 cases to zero. Like, we want to see decline in these infectious diseases overall. And so whatever, you know, efforts we're going to put into place, we want to see that accomplished, and vaccines do that. Okay. So that first check. They also want to protect the most vulnerable child. So the child who has living in a house where there is smokers, there is, you know, it's overcrowded, they're going to daycare, they are not breastfed, they have some form of immune insufficiency. The majority of the time we can kind of like stack up and identify risk factors. Sometimes we can't. So some parent or some children are born with immune insufficiencies. We want to know that we are doing things to protect those children. And that's really, you know, those are the two kind of things we keep in mind as a public health standpoint. What we don't do is look at individual. That's not what public health does. They look at the public's health as a whole. Okay, and so when it comes to the individual, I think it's important to kind of recognize, and this is what Dr. Alana and I really emphasize in our program, what is the kind of rate of this infection? How common is this infection for my child and their location based on their age? And that's really important, and that differs for each vaccine. And we might kind of talk about certain vaccines where it's like, okay, well, my child, you know, based on like where they're living or their age and kind of what how we might be exposed to this, they're not, you know, at risk. How does this get into my child, or how can my child be infected by this? That's another big thing. And then what is that risk for my child? And it is changing based on ages. So for some children, it's riskier when they're younger. For other, not some children, I should say, for some illnesses or infections, it's riskier the younger they are. For some infections, it's riskier the older you get. And so it's very important to kind of understand these infections, how they operate, how common they are, how your child would get one, and then that can allow you to make that informed decision. So I think your original question was like, what are the problems here?
Yeah.
The problems here is that some of the strategies that we have for these infections is to kind of vaccinate children while parents are compliant, for lack of a better explanation. It's convenient for the practice, for the physician. And it's, you know, they're already in this realm of like, we're just doing these vaccines. If you actually pull it apart, they don't all make sense. Like the timing just doesn't make sense. And we could change that for, again, the vast majority of children because they don't have those particular risk factors or, you know, they can't even get symptoms of the illness. Some of them, they don't even develop symptoms of the illness till later. So we could choose to delay. But we have become so accustomed to falling into this rhythm of like, these are the vaccines you get at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, because it's simple and easy. Once you start individualizing it for the child, it takes a lot of effort on the part of the practitioner. In the standard pediatric practice, they don't have the time to sit there and design an individualized schedule for the child and to ensure that it is following the guidelines that the CDC has laid out for a catch-up schedule. And so that's what I find from a lot of pediatricians is one big issue is that, hey, we will follow a schedule. You just bring it to us. You do the work. We will be happy to implement it as long as it makes sense, but you need to kind of do that work. The other big issue is just the fact that this is now public health's recommendation. This is the standard of care. Your provider is held to following the standard of care. If they deviate from that, then they incur extra liability. And so I have a lot of compassion for pediatricians because they are kind of, their lips are held shut in a regard. You know, not to say there's some pediatricians out there that they'll have this conversation, this back and forth conversation, but it's very rare that I find a pediatrician will recommend a family deviating from that unless the family has first brought up some level of concern.
Right. Yes. Okay. You've just brought up so many great points there. Like, for example, what you're talking about is in terms of a timing of a vaccine that may not make sense, but is most convenient on a public health standpoint would be something like the hepatitis B vaccine given
correct
on the first day of birth to newborns. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So hepatitis B, I always kind of relate this one to like HIV. Okay. So do we think our 2-month-old needs an HIV vaccine? Probably not, because it's sexually transmitted and transmitted through blood. Now, yes, hepatitis B can stay on surfaces for longer. Yes, I get some freak accidents happen. Like that's possible. But if you're actually looking at the rate of a child contracting hepatitis B in childhood from something other than like mom to baby is very small. We're looking at like 3 to 10 kids per year, all the way from 0 to 18, right? So could have been an older child. We don't know. Contracting hepatitis B from some freak accident. It's not super common. So, you know, and we could go back through history and how this has changed, but prior to this 1986 law being changed, around granting vaccines liability protection, hepatitis B was given to those who were, exhibiting risk at-risk behavior, so drug users and sexual promiscuity. And as you can imagine, it wasn't a super effective way to decrease hepatitis B rates because those individuals weren't necessarily coming in to get vaccinations. So it's a much more effective way to just vaccinate a whole population and decrease the rates over time. So
in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So and this leads me into the next question as well, which is the what would be sort of the, or do you have, or it's every single child is individual, I'm certain to some extent, but what would be your sort of standard delayed schedule recommendation?
Yeah, great. I don't have one.
Good answer.
I don't know. It's so interesting. I would love to count it up, but maybe have created like 1,000 schedules. I don't know. I would have to go back and, you know, look at them all. I don't know if I have a single schedule that's the same. I just don't know if I do because it so much depends on the parent's level of risk aversion. The child, like, do they have siblings? Do they have any sort of what their family history is? Was mom vaccinated or not? Are they going into daycare? Do they plan on taking travel? There's so many factors that go into play that my schedules vary so much. What I will say is I think there's some principles that are very guiding for me. So in the first four, or sorry, I should say what I tell parents is like, focus on the first year of life first. Okay. So the first year of life, the vaccines that you need to make a decision about are Hib, PCV, DTaP, rotavirus, and now the RSV monoclonal antibody. So there's five. Okay. Everything else can be delayed. So the other vaccines that they'll commonly give during this time period are hepatitis B and polio. And so it's not like a ton more, but those two we are just not going to think about right now. For the vast majority of kids, it doesn't apply. So based on those other vaccines, it really has to do with, is mom breastfeeding? Are you planning on putting into childcare in the first year of life? Do you have older siblings? Are you traveling? Does the child have any other health conditions that could, you know, compromise their immune health or, you know, could compromise their immune system in any way? And then a lot of it, and seasonally, so some children that, like a child who was born in the summer might be different than a child who was born in the winter. And so like, what season are we entering into? What are rates? That's a big one. So for instance, pertussis rates have changed drastically post-pandemic. They went from like, you know, we used to see over 15 to 19,000 cases a year that were tracked. Then it went down to like 1 to 2,000 cases per year. And now it's starting to climb back up. But we look a lot at like rates. Where are you in the state? Like, are you in Are you hanging around a bunch of unvaccinated people? Are you hanging around everyone who's vaccinated? What state do you live in? What is it, rural? You know, even pertussis, for instance, I live in San Diego. You used to live in San Diego. San Diego has the highest rates of pertussis of all the counties, significantly higher, significantly higher. So that individual might be different than someone who lives in, I don't know, some rural county in San Diego. So it is so different based on the family. And that's what I wish, you know, a provider would sit down and do for the families, because that's we believe in individualized medicine. And I think it's so important when it comes to this, because this is one of the biggest medical decisions that you'll make for your child in their first year of life.
Wow, that was awesome. Yeah. And that is exactly how it should be. It's and like you said too, the parental level of assumption of risk, like what are you willing to manage and how do you, you know, fully understanding the way that the illness presents and its own side effects and sequelae, yeah, because it's, you know, some of them are really scary, like the meningitis causing illnesses, you know, Hib and PCV. So off of that, I'm looking at, there's a question that is really similar, which is, okay, you had said if mom is vaccinated or not, and somebody actually asked this, if mom wasn't vaccinated, does this change things for the house you would recommend this different schedule for her own babies?
In some degree, yes. I mean, as it pertains to, so we don't use flu vaccine in this way, and we don't give children under 6 months the flu vaccines, but like you in COVID, you know, like you could say that changes their risk profile for those illnesses. But really what we use this for, you know, in one of my questions when I'm doing a vaccine consultation with a family is, did mom get Tdap in pregnancy? So if mom got Tdap in pregnancy, and let's just say that the family is traveling a lot, they have a lot of siblings, you know, they're putting their child in daycare, something where there's going to be a lot of exposure and parents are very worried about pertussis. yes, like if that's one example of like mom getting a vaccine will, or mom being unvaccinated will change the child's risk profile in those kind of first few months. And we might do different things for that particular child. So again, if a child wasn't, if mom wasn't vaccinated, she had a brand new child who had a ton of risk for exposures, we might choose to do a vaccine, that DTaP vaccine earlier on, 6 weeks to 2 months, or a child, you know, or mom who wasn't, sorry, was vaccinated. I'm hoping I got this right. If she was vaccinated, then we would definitely delay until at least 3 months. But usually we can have a little bit of confidence. Sometimes we won't do it till 4 months. So,
okay.
The other thing we can do is if mom just chooses, like, I don't want to get the vaccine in pregnancy and I don't want to vaccinate early on, we might have a conversation around, okay, do you want to do the vaccination and pass on, if you're breastfeeding, and pass on some of those antibodies through your breast milk? They're different, but they are still provide some level of protection.
Okay. And so of those that you were saying that are going to be the most important for the first year of life, including the RSV, monoclonal antibodies, and rotavirus, mm-hmm. and then Hib, PCV, and DTaP. Mm-hmm. Where's varicella in that? That's
chickenpox is typically given between the first one, 12 to 15 months.
And when do you think is the optimal time to get that one? That was a question we had.
No, yeah, I do think you should consider it.
We never
haven't gotten chickenpox by puberty because right after puberty, like once you kind of go through puberty, it's going to get pretty gnarly and it can be quite severe. So if you hadn't gotten it, let's say by 10, 11 years of age, then it may be, you know,
in your best interest, yeah, to look into getting a vaccine. Mm-hmm. But it's something that you could delay longer, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, chickenpox, you had chickenpox, I had chickenpox, a lot of people did, but it did change. So came out in 94. And so depending on how, like I always say 80s babies usually had chickenpox, 90s babies are like these transitional babies. So it kind of just depends where you fall in that, like your parents, how proactive they were. But, you know, some, you know, so some people had it, some people didn't. But in children, it's a pretty well-tolerated illness. After that puberty standpoint, it gets much more severe. For males, it's more severe than for females after puberty. But for pregnant women, it's a huge risk. So it can cause birth defects. It can cause pneumonia. It can cause death in moms. So, yeah, I definitely think that, you know, if you haven't had the wild infection, at some point, you might want to consider that one because you do not want to get it as an adult.
As an adult, right, exactly. Okay, and then you just kind of reminded me of, and this is another question, okay, this whole measles come back. What's your stance?
Totally. Yeah, I think it's coming back. I mean, unfortunately, I think so. Measles is one, there, and this is all different depending on the vaccine. It's really important to clarify, like, what is the intention of the vaccine? Is the intention of the vaccine to prevent illness? Is the protection of the vaccine to prevent severe symptoms? Is the intention of the vaccine to prevent certain symptoms? Okay, so each vaccine is different in what we expect to be kind of the outcome and what contributes to quote-unquote efficacy. So efficacy for each vaccine is different, which is interesting. So for the efficacy for the measles, mumps, rubella is that you don't get symptoms of the illness. You don't get the illness, okay? And the MMR vaccine for measles is pretty effective. It is. So after one shot, it's about 93% effective. After two shots, it's 97% effective. It's also very effective for rubella. It's not effective for mumps. Okay, so that's a little bit different. But when it comes to measles, we know that there's this kind of like 95% immunity threshold where we see that measles doesn't spread very much. Because if you have 95% of the population vaccinated, yes, you might have a case here or there, but it's not going to spread because everyone else around you is kind of going to like, it's going to stop the spread. And measles is a very, very contagious virus. And so, you know, we have kind of record low vaccine uptake. And that herd immunity is falling. And so we are going to expect, we should expect to see some level of spread, and especially if it hits one of those unvaccinated communities, there's nothing stopping it. It's kind of like wildfire. So it will kind of burn through that. Now, eventually, I guess you could say, is like if people start getting the wild type of measles that also kind of adds to the herd immunity. So there might be this like original spread and then it could like level out over time because we have more wild immunity. But in general, I do think, I mean, we can see globally, we have outbreaks. The US so far is not super scary right now as March 1, right? So there's an outbreak in Florida, but everything else has been pretty well controlled and well maintained. And even the Florida isn't like out of control yet, but it's still too early to say. But yes, I do think that we should be like watchful of this one. And I do think this is one where I don't necessarily believe that, especially in children under 5, I'm not telling parents to strive for natural immunity. Like we might talk about varicella. I think that measles is definitely, you know, a pretty severe illness, for many, I should say. And so, I do think we will see cases rise.
And so this whole, you know, it's thrown around a lot that, well, all of our parents had measles and it was like the chickenpox of yesteryear in that way that it was, you know, there's that Brady Bunch scene that's always played and quoted and talked about. And so what do you think? You think it's more severe than people are thinking?
Well, I think a little bit of, I think that every illness has like, there's varying ranges of illness, right? So it kind of depends on when you get it. And a lot of the measles illnesses was hit when kids were older, like between like 5 and 9. And that's an age range where kids are going to have less severe symptoms. But I guess just looking at statistics wise, and I think it is difficult to say because obviously medicine has changed so much since we had measles in the 60s. Okay. And so some of our rates around like encephalitis and things of that nature are really outdated. But if we were to just look back at like 2019 outbreak, because that's like the most recent data that we had 10% were hospitalized, 5% had some form of severe complication, including pneumonia or encephalitis. So we didn't have deaths, right? But 10% being hospitalized for an illness is like pretty significant, 5%. I think the pneumonia can be pneumonia, right? Like we have pneumonia. That was our last death. So do I think it's like the scariest of scariest illnesses out there? No, but it does. I do believe, and that we know that there are some risks. I mean, encephalitis, even if it's only 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 3,000, that's significant. Like that can lead to permanent neurological damage. And I don't want to downplay that and lead a family to believe that measles is no big deal and their child is the one who gets encephalitis.
Right, right. I can understand that.
I'll say one other thing. I do think that for measles, there is, and I always tell this to my patients, and this is not like, this is as a parent, this is your kind of determination, whether or not this is something that you feel strongly about or not. But there are individuals of our society who cannot get the vaccine. So if you are on an immunosuppressant drug for, let's say, an autoimmune disorder, you cannot get this vaccine because if you get this vaccine, you could die of the vaccine, but you could also die of the illness. Individuals with cancer who are going through chemotherapy, they cannot get this vaccine. Individuals who have some form of genetic immune insufficiency, they cannot get this vaccine because it's a live vaccine. And so if they got this live vaccine, that live vaccine could start to replicate and could take full-blown measles or mumps or rubella. And you know, we have cases of that and cases of children dying because they got this vaccine and not knowing that they had something underlying that was suppressing their immune function. And so part of this kind of herd immunity is protection for those that are vulnerable and those that cannot, if they, you know, they would otherwise choose to, but they cannot get the vaccine and they're most vulnerable to the most significant risks. And this is really, you know, this is something that's talked about a lot in terms of like the unvaccinated or the unvaccinated putting another population at risk. There's really not a strong argument for most vaccines or most vaccine preventable illness, but there is a strong argument for measles.
Okay. That's good to know. Thanks for that delineation. And on that, my next one, we'll just, you're segueing into these so well.
Okay.
So what do you think about just sort of in general about these large populations of unvaccinated children that are, certain areas?
Unfortunately, this is what I think. I am sad that we have government influence that they have to be segmented in these little, you know, segments, right? So like the unvaccinated children hang out with unvaccinated children because they aren't allowed to hang out with vaccinated children. And that's our government doing, right? So that's something that's a huge bummer about it, because if it was like more homogenous, there would be less risk of spread of some of these illnesses. And I don't know if you remember this, but it really stuck with me. One of our professors said, I moved down here from Oregon because I didn't want, there was too many unvaccinated children and his children were unvaccinated. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but
I'll
okay,
have to remind going. You after yeah. this call. And I was like, what a hypocrite.
Yeah, that
and
is
then I thought about it and I was like, okay, no, he's actually being very intentional. He understands that, hey, I'm not choosing to utilize these vaccines as a, for my own children because I understand that there are risks, right? And I also recognize that if they are hanging around a bunch of other children that are unvaccinated, they're more likely to come in contact with these infections. And I also equally recognize that there's risk to these infections. My choice is not to vaccinate them, but I still want to limit their exposure.
But risk mitigation is can come in many forms.
Wow. Can come in many forms, yeah.
That is so interesting. It's almost like the way I see it in my mind is I think sometimes I have that like whatever it is where you only think in pictures. I don't know what it is. But as you're speaking, all these pictures are just going through my head. Yeah. And I'm thinking of overlapping, colorful, like every factor has its own color and they're sort of like transparent so that when they overlap on top of each other, they're making other colors behind them and you can see how they're overlapping. And it's like the way that risk mitigation is constantly changing and shifting. And as for one particular child, just one child from zero to say 10, how their risk mitigation will change based on, yes, where they live, siblings, school, other kids around them, seasons, all these different things you're saying. And for parents to sort of be able to navigate this, I can understand too why the CDC and public health standpoint on an epidemiological level, they're just like, nope, we have absolutely no time to do that.
I think it's a really good point because this is one form of risk mitigation. It's not the only form of risk mitigation. So it is a tool and it is an effective tool for not like 100% effective, but it is one of our most effective tools. And so, you know, in their standpoint, it's like, why aren't you doing this a tool? Like, why aren't you using, we're giving you this tool and you're choosing not to use it. You don't have to. Like, you can choose other tools of risk mitigation. I think that what I've become discouraged and a little bit disillusioned by in terms of my, you know, seeing how polarized vaccines have become is that if we choose not to vaccinate our children, we must also assume that the illnesses are not of concern. And I don't approach it from that standpoint. I think we can have, you know, we can hold both of these beliefs that there these illnesses can be a concern, varying, you know, with varying risk profiles, and they all have, you know, in terms of like the severity and the likelihood. And I also might choose a different route of protection for my child.
Right. Like really intentional nutrition, breastfeeding for an extended period of time, you know,
not putting your child in daycare for the first year of life. Like there are things that I talk about with my patients. I'm like, you don't want to vaccinate during the first year of life. Great. Or you don't want to vaccinate at all. Great. Okay. What does that mean that you need to be a little bit more mindful of during this time period? Now there's still, as everyone knows, many other illnesses out there that, you know, we don't have a vaccine for. Like forever, you know, we never talked about RSV until now we have a vaccine for it. So now we talk about it and now we talk about risk. But like that wasn't one that we were like blasting with air horns about like the potential risks until we have now a solution for it. And now we do. So, you know, and I think that's interesting now with my new vaccine consults because it's something that we've kind of incorporated. But prior to this, no one cared about RSV or the risks of RSV because they didn't know any way what we could do about it. So at any rate, yes, I do think that there are ways that we can be very intentional about protecting our child's immune system and supporting its resilience. And just in general, something that I share with parents, it's like, even if we have all of our vaccines, let's say the child is fully vaccinated, these are still choices. A lot of those same choices around breastfeeding and daycare are things that I speak about from a neurodevelopment standpoint. Because again, even if it's an infection, that infection creates inflammation. And not to say that we're trying to dodge illnesses forever, but there is this window where every, you know, if we have a child that is, and again, I speak from this in like a place of privilege, and I acknowledge that this is not everyone's, like not everyone has the opportunity to keep their children at home through that first year of life. But when we have a child who's repeatedly getting sick, too, ear infection after ear infection after ear infection or things of that nature, that is also an immune stimulus. That is also an immune input, just like a vaccine is, and that also has implications on their neurodevelopment. So that, you know, I think that there, this is like something I'm passionate about. Like, how do we support a protective and healthy environment and, you know, support immune resilience?
Yeah. And I mean, I understand that, you know, not, well, with the way that our overall country health is declining and the overall increased rates of chronic illness that are happening in children, the maybe just average child doesn't have the resilience, given the nutrition and the different factors and everything, to have the same outcome that sometimes some of these other illnesses might have been in yesteryear, would you say?
100%. 100%. The other thing I'll say, it's super interesting. I mean, I could go all into this because to be honest, we don't even know some of these things, how they've changed over time. So HIB is like one really good example where Haemophilus influenza B used to take, like, we used to have 15,000 cases of invasive HIB each year prior to the vaccine. And now we have like 40, but we still have a huge part of the population that's not getting vaccinated. So like, what is accounting for the difference? And when they've like looked at studies more recently, looking at individuals who got HIB and who didn't get HIB, and actually looking at their nasal passages to see, you know, do they, we see it in their nasal passages, there's only about like a 1% difference. Well, I mean, there's like 2.4% of the population who was vaccinated has this in their nasal passages, whereas like 3.5% of those that are unvaccinated has this in their nasal passages. But over time, like, I guess there's a couple things. So one, that's not that big of a difference. So whether you're vaccinated or not vaccinated, you still have this in their nasal passages. Now, the part of the reason why this vaccine works is not to prevent you from getting it, but prevent you from having it go invasive, okay? But over time, it's not that that rate has changed that much, okay? So let's say now with vaccinated kids, we have 2.4% of them have been in their nasal passages. Before this vaccine, we had about like 7.7% of them have it in their nasal passages. So for all the population, it's gone down, okay? But there's also likely been in this time period, like there, you know, we still have it. It's still here, still in unvaccinated kids. We don't see huge rates of it. Part of me thinks that there has to have also been a change in the virulence of this bacteria. And that can happen with the vaccines too. Like, we know this about even the strep pneumoniae vaccine. Like, certain strains that used to be more virulent, used to be more dangerous, I should like as a term. So they used to be more dangerous, maybe are a little bit less dangerous now. So like the dangers of these bacteria probably has shifted a little bit too because of some of the vaccines, and just that, like, just like antibiotics resistance and things of that nature, like things do shift over time. So I think there
it's
are
just another factor to think about, and in all of this there's so many moving parts.
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. 95% of women are deficient in omega-3s, one of the most important nutrients, not only for fertility, but also for the baby's and mama's health once she becomes pregnant. Omega-3 fats are critical for baby's brain and eye development and have been shown to support the cardiovascular system, immune system, and lead to healthier skin and joints. They support memory and cognitive function as well as mood. They are powerful nutrients that are not only essential for baby, but good for mama too. One of our favorite brands, Needed, has created a high quality and high potency fish oil option to get the EPA and DHA omega-3s needed for mama and baby during these critical seasons. If you had to pick one supplement after a prenatal to get on board while preparing for pregnancy, trying to conceive, while pregnant or postpartum, it's omega-3s. Visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Again, that's thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. Okay, back to the show.
Yeah, you're like, yes, it's exhausting, but you love it. I love how much you love it. I have a couple like maybe quicker ones, and then I have the big one. The big one. You know what I'm talking about. Okay. So some people wanted to know, you know, speaking of risk mitigation, the idea of homeoprophylaxis. Do you have any thoughts on this? I know it's not your specialty, but
I get a lot of questions about this. I guess I personally, you know this about me and my practice. Like I've never fully, I love homeopathy. I think it's amazing, but it's not like a tool that I use. So I don't use homeoprophylaxis. I also think it's very it's not how we were trained. So we were trained in classical homeopathy, and this is like a little bit, it's different in that matter. So you're giving like a micro dose of the exact illness or like a teeny tiny, like Avogadro's number, right? So it's like, I guess where I am with it is that we have nothing to say it's effective. So like it's never been studied. So I can't speak to it. Like I'm not opposed to it. I don't think it's dangerous. I just have no idea whether it's effective because it's never actually been studied or looked at.
And it's like a very low risk profile as well, given that it's
totally,
you know, homeopathic in preparation, but maybe to put a lot of stock in it would just not be fair to say
I
that it's effective.
Put my homeopathic or homeoprophylactically protected child, you know, let's say they're, you know, my 2-month-old who has homeoprophylaxis in a room with pertussis with like great confidence that they weren't going to get pertussis.
Yeah, I understand that. That makes sense to me. I wouldn't do that either. There's just certain things that even if you wish and want and believe in homeopathy in that other kind of way, this is more of like a weird epidemiological preventative homeopathy that, not to say that it doesn't work, but yeah, I agree with you. It's a really difficult concept to understand and we just don't really have that much research about it. There's not that much research about homeopathy in general, but there is some.
There is some
and it's okay. So anyways, okay, that was a good one. Let's see. Is there any testing that can be done in order to sort of predict the adverse reaction risk from vaccines that you would suggest to families?
Okay, so there's a newer genetic test that I'm really loving from a company called Intellix DNA. And they have, I mean, there's different genetic tests out there as well. But one of the things that I really love, it's really geared towards neurodevelopment. So like all of your autism genes, your detoxification genes, your nutrient metabolism genes. But there's a couple that are related to inflammation. And so if we're, again, like we're going to get to that, but inflammation in the brain, right, is a potential risk factor here. And so, yes, there's some very specific genes that we're looking at relating to that. And then there's some specific genes that we're looking at relating to aluminum metabolism. So it's a cheek swab. You can do this as soon as baby's born if you were interested in doing it. It's expensive, but
always so expensive.
It is an investment for their life because right from that point, you understand their vulnerabilities. So that's one big thing that I use.
And that's because I just want to say too, so people that don't know you, is that you also have a particular passion in helping families who maybe have a child with autism spectrum disorder prevent future children from the same disorder, from maybe if it was something that was preventable during the pregnancy or, you know, from that neurodevelopmental and inflammatory perspective. So this test would be, it's like beautiful for you.
Yeah, I use it a lot in my practice to inform vaccine decisions, but also to understand right from the start, where are those levels of vulnerability? So we know, is this a child that's vulnerable to toxins? If so, which ones? Is this child vulnerable to certain nutrient metabolism concerns? If so, how do we support them? Are they vulnerable to, you know, oxidative stress, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? What can we do to safeguard these vulnerabilities?
Okay. And I know somebody's going to ask, what about MTHFR and vaccine adverse reaction?
Yeah, I don't think it's the biggest one. Okay. So not at all. MTHFR potentially, right? So there's one study. And then, so that's why I think it's been like, wah! And we know in general, MTHFR has been like very much popularized. It is a risk factor for autism. It's very much on the lower rung. Okay. But if you have C677T primarily, okay, so it's not primarily, only C677T are we concerned about. And if you were homozygous for that, then I do think maybe there's a little bit more of a concern. And it can impact, you know, glutathione production. So that's one of our body's chief antioxidants and how we protect against the oxidative stress of something like aluminum. But it's not the main one.
What is the main one, in your opinion? So, or maybe a few. I'm sure there are several.
Yeah. I mean, from a brain inflammation standpoint, there's genetics related to interleukin 1 beta, interleukin 6, and TNF alpha. Those are the main cytokines that cause this microglial activation. And if you are a child that has excess production of one of these cytokines, whether that be from illness or any other form of immune activation, we want to be extra mindful. And so this is, you know, the research around the research that's out there that is suggestive of vaccines as a playing a role in neurodevelopmental regressions really focus on this microglial activation. And so they talk a lot about these three cytokines, okay? And so that interleukin 1 beta from a common variant standpoint, okay? So for autism, the vast majority of time is not related to a genetic condition. So there are genetic conditions out there. Rett syndrome and Fragile X and things of that nature that can have autism as part of their kind of presenting features. But the majority of autism is kind of multifactorial. There's not a single gene that causes autism, but rather there are a variety of genes that create some vulnerabilities to things within our environment that could alter neurodevelopment. And so of those common variants, interleukin 1 beta, there's genes that are related to this production of this cytokine that are now, this is now the biggest risk factor for autism. Okay. So this particular gene, out of all of the genes that we can look for, this particular gene is the biggest risk factor for autism. What does it do? It causes inflammation in the brain after some form of immune stimulus. So I think that that's one of the most pertinent ones. But then there are genes related to aluminum metabolism like CCL2 and MCP1. So there's other ones that are related to like an immune activation standpoint that are significant. I think are more significant than MTHFR.
Okay. Well, since we're kind of going there. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No. Go ahead.
I was going to say, since we're sort of going down that track, so then, you know, what are your thoughts on the connection between vaccination and autism? The big question.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot of people, as you know, and I think this was one of your questions, focus on toxins. And mercury is no longer in childhood vaccines outside of a multi-dose flu vaccine, and you can avoid that. And so, yes, mercury has a role in altered neurodevelopment. So now, of all the – like, there's definitely ingredients in there that we don't love. Okay, that's just part of it. Are they at a level that can induce, like, direct toxicity is the next question. And love understanding pathways and really understanding, you know, this about me. I really like understanding mechanisms and being very specific about like what we're speaking of. And so, you know, things like formaldehyde is one of those ingredients in there. Formaldehyde, it can be a risk factor for neurodevelopment. And there's a gene that is a risk factor that it's kind of, we know that it increases the risk of autism that's related to impaired formaldehyde metabolism. The question, though, becomes like, is there actually enough formaldehyde in vaccines to be something of concern? And I don't know at this point that there is. Maybe for those that are very genetically vulnerable, but not for the majority, I don't believe. And there's many other things that I find more concerning about formaldehyde, like the fact that like it's in all of our building materials. And I'd personally be more concerned about like a child living in a very brand new home in their formaldehyde exposure versus the formaldehyde within a vaccine. Okay. Other things like aluminum, I think there's definitely a bigger case for aluminum and a risk around aluminum within vaccines. And so what is it doing and how can it cause harm? One of the major ways is it causes a lot of oxidative stress, okay? And we know that there can be these impaired redox systems in children with autism. And so we need to balance that with appropriate amounts of antioxidants to protect the brain against the oxidative stress that can occur with aluminum. The other thing is that it can impact mitochondrial function. It can also activate brain inflammation, which we'll talk about, and that's really my main theory around like how vaccines could impact neurodevelopment. But I do think aluminum presents like as one separate risk, or not separate necessarily, because it is still kind of feeding into some of these mechanisms. But that's one ingredient that I do think is of a concern, and that we need to be very mindful of. How do we spread out? How do we choose vaccines with lower amounts? Can we delay it if we don't need it? Can we skip it? Like those types of conversations should be had, because we know that there's a safety. Well, we don't know where that safety limit lies, but we know that there is one, right? And so, and that's a whole other conversation. But aluminum, and that could be a role. Now, the main mechanism that I explain to my patients, and this is just something that's very well researched, is this understanding that the immune system plays a major role in neurodevelopment. And so again, kind of going back to that first question around vaccines and pregnancy and risk, potential risk, we know that these cells within the brain called the microglia play a very big role into the early architecture of the brain. They set up new pathways, they tear down old pathways. And if they are, we call them activated, so if the microglia are activated by immune triggers typically, then they stop doing their job appropriately and they can create a bunch of brain inflammation within the brain.
Meaning like one individual microglia can become activated, sort of turned on. It will not now do its job until it dies?
Kind of. Like it kind of, but we also see like an increased production of these other, like other microglia. Okay. So they become activated.
Zombie microglia.
Yeah. So they, and to be honest, like there's probably way more nuance to this conversation that I, as a, not a neurologist or an immunologist, like have yet to understand. But just in the simplified realm,
yes,
the microglia, as they become activated, they stop typical neurodevelopment. And actually we see this. So we see this in that they stop tearing down these pathways and these children's heads grow in size. So one of my questions that I always ask parents is, did your child's head grow? Like, did it go from the 50th percentile to the 80th percentile? That's a risk. That's showing us that the brain is enlarging, and that is telling us there's some form of immune activation occurring.
Whoa, that's wild. And you're seeing that.
Oh, yeah. Or, yeah. So we see, like, if your child has macrocephaly. Now, some children don't be alarmed, because if you take a lot of omegas in pregnancy, then you're going to be born with a child that has a big brain and big head. And then that's not always a concern. But if macrocephaly, this enlarged brain, is a feature that we see in children with autism, especially around regressions. So we see enlarging of the head, like where it started out a particular size and then it got bigger over time.
So if immune system activation is a big risk factor for the way that neurodevelopment goes well or not, are we to avoid our children getting sick? It sounds, you know, I mean,
yeah, well,
I know
that
that's
a good question. I think, so this is where the research comes. When they talk about immune activation, they always allude to illness. And so they say, you know, there's regressions following fevers. Like we know that 70% of regressions are preceded by a fever. And so this is where it's like, it's hard as a naturopathic doctor, because again, we don't believe in germ, well, not that everyone, but like we want to emphasize terrain over germ theory and all of this. And we, you know, how do you build your immune system if you never let your child get sick? Like all of those things are really good questions and like to bring to the table and probably to be determined. I do think there's a limit, and that's why it goes back to the daycare kind of a recommendation. The first year of life is not a time period that I want the child getting sick all the time. So for instance, like I chose for my, like with Bo, my son, that Maya was in preschool during that time, and she was bringing home everything. We were sick every 2 weeks, and I was like, I just can't do that. Like we're taking her out, partially because it's really hard on our family, but a big part of that is like I'm concerned about him getting sick and having this, you know,
continuous
immune activation.
Right. It's different from being sick here and there if they're just continually bam, 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 one thing after another, like if they're with no break. That would make sense that would not be beneficial.
Or severe illness. So yes, I do think there's like this one of my questions is, during the first 2 years of life, how many fevers has your child had? And I do think the more significant, more frequent, more significant illness likely do play a risk, because again, illness activates those same cytokines, that interleukin 1 beta, that TNF alpha, those interleukin 6 in susceptible children. Now, again, what researchers suggest is that it doesn't activate it as significantly, or as the duration is not as long as what we see in vaccinations. And especially when you're giving like 8 vaccines at one time, like that's a way more significant immune activation than an illness. But I think we have to think about both of these in that conversation. If we're going to talk about immune activation, then both are kind of at the table and have a potential impact in neurodevelopment.
So there is a potential that the immune stimulus of a vaccination could contribute to autism.
Yeah, I definitely believe that's the case.
Isn't it wild that the mainstream situation wants to say that no, there's absolutely no link, no way?
Yeah. And that's where I usually tell parents, if you are going to advocate for your child and you have concerns around vaccines, instead of bringing up the conversation around toxins, because you're not going to win that conversation, it's just like going to be a mute point. Bring up the conversation of immune activation, because no one can argue that. We know that's the whole intention of a vaccination. And we know that sometimes the immune system doesn't respond in the intended way. And that's just unfortunately the case. Sometimes it does. Sometimes we build antibodies. We don't get an excessive inflammatory response. We don't get an autoimmune response. Sometimes we do.
Okay. Speaking of toxins, people want to know, can you mm-hmm. safely detox from a vaccine, or what does that look like? What are you even detoxing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think, again, the toxin of concern, in my opinion, is aluminum, is the toxin of concern. So the detox really pertains to those vaccinations. In terms of like detoxification from, let's say, MMR, it's a pretty clean vaccine outside of like neomycin, which is an antibiotic, but like how you detox from that is like very different. It's like pooping and, it's just very different in terms of like, I actually haven't looked into it. So I can't speak to it exactly like how that goes through the body and like metabolism wise, what liver enzyme it uses, et cetera. But I don't expect that you're going to have like bioaccumulation of neomycin and you have to do some intense detoxification for it. Okay. So when I'm speaking about detoxification, it's really pertaining to aluminum, and yes, maybe some other ingredients like formaldehyde or polysorbate 80 or those things, but aluminum specifically I'll speak to, because that can bioaccumulate. So that's the other thing about toxins. Everything has a half-life. Some things get stored in tissue, some things don't. Aluminum is one that can get stored in tissue. So maybe it is a little bit more important that we are more intentional about ensuring that our body doesn't store it and it eliminates it. So aluminum, it's a little bit different than some of the other heavy metals, which is important to understand. And one of the ways to most effectively get rid of it is through binding it with malic acid. Malic acid helps you excrete it in your urine more efficiently. So magnesium malate is kind of what I use. It's magnesium bound with malic acid, and that can be used. Beyond that, I really focus on a lot of antioxidants to protect the brain from oxidative stress. So things like glutathione are really helpful. Bacopa is really helpful. Quercetin. There's a bunch of antioxidants. Polyphenols are helpful at protecting the brain from that oxidative stress. Other things have been shown to be helpful. Actually, silica, high amounts of like high dose silica water. So there's been studies about this. And silica is just a mineral, and it's found in high amounts in something like Fiji water. So I know of practitioners who use Fiji water or high amounts of Fiji water around the vaccinations, and that can kind of help with aluminum elimination. And then, there's a whole host of other things that probably have less research, but potentially could be helpful, but definitely aren't my top like first choice, but things like chlorella and apple citrus pectin and zeolite all have some level of affinity for aluminum.
Awesome. You are so smart. Okay. What are some of the best tools and resources that parents can use in helping to learn the things that you do and in helping guide and just, help them guide them in their decision making of what vaccines to choose, when, if any, and can you tell us about your vaccine empowerment program more? Because I know that this is probably going to leave people chomping at the bit to get more of you.
Totally. Yeah. Yes, I when Alana Rimmel, which we both know and love, when she approached me about a vaccine program, I think both of us were like, do we really want to do this? And then we thought about it, and it's like, no, actually, like there are so many people that are dying to get this information. And even in regards to like my own practice, we just can't keep up with the vaccine consultations. Like we have
too many people.
A lot of parents who are very interested and very confused and very conflicted, and they want to have a safe space to have a conversation, to express their concerns, and not be given just one side of the story. And so, so Dr. Alana and I collaborated to create the Vaccine Empowerment Program. We can link it here in the show notes. And we walk through each of these vaccines in that way. So what is really important to understand the infectious disease, and that's kind of number one. So how are you exposed? how common is this and what is the risk of the illness? And then also, what are the risks of the vaccine? So what do we know about the vaccine? Where, you know, how can we be thoughtful if we're going to give our child that particular vaccine? How can we think about the timing? How can we choose the appropriate brand? How can we support them pre and post? If we're not going to give our child that vaccine, how can we protect them in other ways? So yes, we have the Vaccine Empowerment Program. We'll link that there. For those that have done a lot of vaccine research and they really just want someone to look over a schedule or have that, you know, more personalized approach, then we do have vaccine consultations through our clinic as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ari. This has been so informative. And, you know, maybe in the future we will pick one of these topics and just dive deep into it, because I know that you are like kind of just trying to hold yourself back from going full on, you know, for 45 minutes.
Oh, I know. Like, I don't know how long we've been talking for a while, so we could go forever.
This is great. Yeah. And it's important. And you have such an authority and a well-balanced perspective on it too. I think a lot of people are going to appreciate it because, you know, whether it's their own personal choice or working within the standards of public health or for schooling or whatever, there are going to be a lot of families that are making these choices, and it feels really scary and daunting. And to just know that there are people like you out there that are helping people make the best choice for their child to have the best health outcome, and it's not just a slap one way fits all onto it, is, you know, so comforting. And I think it's the way of the future, and I'm really hoping that more people like you end up infiltrating all over the world, and we can make this as an informed consent and a personal decision, just like all medical situations should be. All medical interventions of any kind, and vaccines are certainly a medical intervention that should have that sort of a respect around it as well. So thank you so much for your time and speaking, and all of these resources will be linked in the show notes for you guys to get more information and find Dr. Ari and her vaccine empowerment program, as well as the link for consultations in case you want to have a one-on-one.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.